So, I think it's now my turn. Thanks for coming over here today. Let me welcome you on behalf of the European Society. We're very pleased today to have a very distinguished speaker, Mr. Karl van Miert, who is the Vice President of the EC Commission and EC Commissioner for Competition. Mr. van Miert will be lecturing about the competitiveness of European industry, as I guess you are all aware of. So I think that's a topic very high on the agenda of European politics. With Mr. van Miert's lecture, we continue a discussion that started like 8 months ago with a first introduction and some reflections by Lord Cofield on the white paper, the 1985 white paper. And I'm very pleased we can continue that discussion today with a commissioner who is actually in charge of making the internal market work, at least a very important part of it. Let me just briefly mention Mr. van Miert's background. He graduated in diplomatic sciences at the University of Ghent and then held a variety of important posts in academics and politics. He was also chair of the Flemish Socialist Party, a member of the European Parliament, also a deputy in the Belgian Parliament. So I think he is a very distinct and very experienced politician. So in 1988, he became a member of the commission. His responsibilities included transport, as well as investment, investment in credit and consumer policy. And then in 1992, he was appointed as vice president of the commission, now as a commissioner in charge of competition policy, one of the most prestigious and certainly high-profile resource. I think you're much rather listening to him than to me, so I just sit down. And let me just thank the European Institute for helping us and for co-chairing the meeting today. And now, Mr. van Miert, you got the floor.
Well, I'm sure you could see the speaker before me. Can you see me behind this? Well, ladies and gentlemen, in the first place, I would like to thank the initiators of this lecture. I'm very honored to be here tonight and to be given the possibility to make a brief introduction. And I hope there will be still a little bit time left for question time. Now, is it right? I think we have to leave this this building at 6 o'clock. Well, then let's go ahead. Well, ladies and gentlemen, the theme of this lecture, competition, employment, and competitiveness of European industry, is of course a very ambitious one. So therefore, please accept my apologies that I have to be brief and just to give outlines of some of the issues involved within half an hour or so. It is now widely accepted, I think, that Europe has been slowly losing competitiveness. It is pressed from both sides these days. At one end of the spectrum of more traditional manufacturing, Europe is losing out because of the emergence of the newly industrialized countries that have made inroads into our export and home markets. And on top of that, many of our sectors are a little bit old-fashioned and did create a lot of overcapacity. Much of this shift is bound to be permanent due to their abundant cheaper labor. And even more worrying is the fact that our future high-tech growth and high-technology industries are losing out to Japan and the United States. Of course, the situation is not totally black, and we have some world-class industries and successes. But nevertheless, this declining competitiveness is a major problem, since the rate of change of competitiveness determines our underlying real growth rate. So wherever you look, you cannot avoid this problem. In addition, and that's another big challenge and problem, the community, or should we now say, of course, the European Union, is facing mass structural unemployment, a problem aggravated by the current cyclical downswing. But even if we come out of recession, we will have unacceptably high levels of unemployment. Let me give you a few figures. Unemployment is now around 17 million people, or 11% of workforce. Even if in 1990, after 5 years of steady growth, when unemployment reached its lowest levels for a decade, there were still 12 million unemployed, or 8% of the labor force. The labor force is expected to grow by around 0.5% a year, and if productivity per employed person were to continue to rise at its historical rate of 1.9%, the average for the period 73-90, we would need, on average, annual growth rate of 2.5% merely to prevent unemployment rising even further. So that means you have to get an economic growth of about 2.5% just to be able to stop unemployment to rise and to increase. And that's certainly not happening today. It might be that in one or other country it looks a little bit better than in others, but it's difficult to see when we will be back at that level. That means that on average in the European community we will have that growth percentage, and that means that only then we can reasonably expect that unemployment, rise of unemployment, will be stopped. Sometimes in political and economic discussions we play with figures around too often, as I'm doing now, such as 11% unemployed. And by the way, in some countries it's of course much, much, much bigger. In Spain it's beyond 20%. Is this an alarm again? No? Okay. Anyway, I will continue. Anyway, it does function well.
Oh.
Okay. So, I just wanted to point out that this figure of 11%, of course, is hiding situations which are much, much more difficult and worse, like in Spain, where the unemployment is beyond 20%. In many parts of the former GDR, now the new Bundesländer, as they are called, there are situations where unemployment, real unemployment, is beyond 50%. And I'm sure you know places in Great Britain where unemployment is 25% or even more than that as well. So this situation is extremely preoccupying, but to some extent, of course, people think, and people also in industry think, that there is a full contradiction between, on the one hand, the need for making our industry more competitive, and on the other hand, trying to solve the problem of unemployment. And now I certainly, I'm not going to say that there is not, to some extent, a certain contradiction. And if, for instance, you are going for privatizing or for liberalizing sectors or companies, it might well be that the most immediate effect of that is shedding of jobs. And in the present circumstances, therefore, but I will come back on that issue, it is increasingly difficult to liberalize some sectors, although, for the sake of competitiveness, it should be done, or it needs to be done. Now, before going into these questions a little bit more into detail, let me say, ladies and gentlemen, or let me recall, that what the single market is about, and also, to a large extent now, the White Book, which will be made public later this week, is to make sure that we get the balance right. That means that you should not go for a policy whereby you create the illusion that you are going to solve the problem of unemployment, but at the end of the day, you make things worse. Let me give you an example. telecom sector. And I know in Great Britain, privatization did have as a result that many jobs were in the first instance at least, were shedded. Now, when you have a situation whereby the tariffs, on average in Europe, are 40% higher than in the US, and in Japan also, tariffs are much lower than in Europe, this is clearly a competitive disadvantage for the whole of our economy. And if you see that a company like Fiat in Italy pays about 20% more for its telecom services than a comparable company does in Great Britain, and that the disadvantage is even 40% when you compare it with the situation in the US, then you see what the problem is. And you can, of course, say today, okay, because such an operation of liberalization needs... Is it going to last a minute? No? So when of course, countries now faced with the need to liberalize the sector and to accept proper competition, make the point that this is going to create immediately a very complicated and politically difficult situation because the result will be the shedding of jobs. That certainly is a real point, and you have to face it. But on the other hand, the longer you put it off, the more you create difficulties for your own industry, because you also prolong the competitive disadvantage of your industry and your companies. So therefore, in spite of the difficulties we have got, we should not reach the conclusion that what needs to be done should just be put off and that we should go for a policy of wait and see. Again, I accept that this is an extremely difficult point, but at the end of the day, it's better to take the decisions now then be faced later on with even more and bigger problems than they are today already. So therefore, I think when you look upon the problem of competition, competitiveness and unemployment, in some sectors, in spite of the economic downturn which we are in spite of the difficulties we have had, it would be a wrong conclusion to backtrack from the objectives which have been agreed upon, like for telecom, or like in the aviation sector, where we do have, since the beginning of this year, so-called third package, that means a common aviation policy and a common market for aviation policy, to stop that and to backtrack from that policy. It would be the wrong choice. And the Commission did make that extremely clear in the framework of the White Book. Now, as you know, but I'm not going to enter into the discussion because the time does not allow it, a lot of other suggestions have been made by the Commission, try to develop a strategy to lower the cost of labor and things like that. It needs to be done. So I'm not saying that only the competition side is the most important side. It is a part of that strategy, but a lot of other decisions need to be taken in other areas as well. So I just wanted to make clear that what I'm saying is part of a more global approach and not just the essential part of it. Now, having said this, ladies and gentlemen, let me now turn to a few other elements of competition policy these days, linked also to the present economic situation and to the need to stimulate the competitiveness of our industry. We have been accused, I might say, in the past, the Commission from time to time, to be too legalistic about competition policy and to be too static about it, and to judge cases in a pure theoretical way, or in a too theoretical way, and not taking into account what's happening in the real world. And I think we must accept to some extent that some of the criticism made in this respect was not completely unfounded. Because, let's face it, lawyers tend to look upon cases in that way, judge the situation as it is versus the experience of the past, and try to keep as strictly as possible to the rules. Now, in the real world, things might be different. And therefore, let me give you a few examples how we try to be also more helpful to our own industry, but at the same time to preserve proper competition, because that still remains the real and crucial criteria for every competition policy. For instance, on the basis of Article 85 and 86, or the crucial articles in the treaty concerning cartels, dominant positions, and so on, in the past, when companies started to cooperate and create a joint venture, almost instinctively, one tended to look upon such cooperation agreements as, you know, something must be wrong, something must be behind. They certainly are going to impede on proper competition, so let's take a very critical view. These days, this is certainly not the right thing to do. Of course, still, you must try to look behind such agreements and see what's happening in the real world also from a competition point of view. But on the other hand, we must recognize that in the real world, in what's happening in the economy needs companies to work together for reasons of research and development, which is a very costly investment. Try to develop new products in a quicker way. Try to get them first on the market. Try to develop a competitive edge. That's what it's all about, more and more these days. So instead of starting to take a reluctant view and think, well, then there must be something wrong. No. Now we try to start by taking a positive view and try and find out if there are problems on the competition side or not. But if not, okay, then you have to go, you have to give your green light and let it go quickly. And therefore, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, from the beginning of this year, we do now have a kind of streamlined procedure whereby the delays within which we handle now, merger cases, that means 9 out of 10 times within 1 month, and the other cases with the most difficult ones, there can be an extra 4 months, but within 5 months, all the questions are cleared. We tend to do now the same, and up to now we could stick to these delays, also when it concerns joint ventures. So we really are trying to do our utmost to be more helpful, to create legal certainty within a given period of time. And by the way, this is a one-stop shop procedure, so once the question has been cleared, there is legal certainty. So in this way, we try to be at the same time preserving competition, but being as helpful as we can, and see the real needs in the real world of our industry and our economic operators. I should perhaps give also another example of what is needed and how, in a dynamic way, you need to look upon some of the competition cases. A few months ago, there was a joint venture in an area which is of considerable importance for the future, liquid crystal displays. Yes, that's what it's called in English? Yeah, okay. Now, we do have 3 major companies in the companies in the commission, in the community, Sagem, Thomson, and Philips, so working on that. Now, they wanted to go for a joint venture. So when, let's say, the classical sense, I would have taken a textbook on competition policy and see what's happening in this community market, 3 main companies joining their forces, the answer must have been no. But the answer has been yes. Why? Because the problem was a different one. It was not a question of community market. It was a question of what's happening in the world market. Because Japanese companies are already ahead. And the real question was whether European companies, in joining forces, tomorrow will still be competitors in the world market. That was the real issue. So these few examples, ladies and gentlemen, tend to show how, again, preserving competition, proper competition, how, on the other side, we try to be as helpful and as positive as we can. Now, let me turn to another issue. That's the issue of state aid. And when I'm doing so, it's not just for the pleasure of doing so, but it's becoming an extremely big and difficult issue. Why? Because in this depressed economic situation, governments, public authorities, politicians, but also industry and trade unions, of course, tend to go to those having money, well, public authorities in the first place, when something happens and there are difficulties, in the steel sector, in other sectors, okay, the first thing they go is and knocking on the door, aviation sector as well, and asking for additional money. So more state. As you know, we do have a set of complicated, but nevertheless a set of complete set of rules to handle state aid cases. Now, in some cases it is admitted, for instance, to help research and development, to stimulate research and development, to stimulate the development of small and medium enterprises, to stimulate activities in the field of environmental policy. So, in some areas, state aids are admitted within a framework, and where the Commission can judge whether given aids are still in that framework. It's true in other sectors as well. As you know, there is this regional policy which has been developed in the European Commission. So there are a lot of cases where state aid is allowed up to a certain intensity and within a certain number of conditions. But outside that, state aid is not allowed. And when it happens, we have to intervene and eventually reclaim the money. It has been done in the Rover case, one of the famous cases here in Great Britain, and they had to pay back the money. Now, that was the policy which we have developed over the years. Now, these days, I must confess that because of this depressed economic situation, the pressure is mounting in all the member states, by the way. It has nothing to do anymore with ideological points of view. It used to be that way. There were governments fighting fiercely all kinds of public aids. These days it becomes a little bit more difficult because everyone has got problems. And even in Great Britain you will these days find some files where the government is trying to get the authorization to admit state aid or to give more state aid. So therefore we are in a critical situation, and certainly as a commission, because if we be too flexible, it is really a short-sighted policy and a bad policy. Because one, practically all the governments do have huge deficits. Secondly, when of course government A is giving state aid in a given situation, others are going to do the same. Now let me give you the example of the steel sector. And by the way, the risk and the possibility is still very much there if in the coming days we do not reach an agreement on the matter of state aid cases in the steel sector. Because what's happening these days? Everyone is nearly all the steel companies are making losses. Some are in acute danger. Now, only some of the companies receive state aid, and in many cases, or in some of the cases, very huge amounts of state aid. We are talking about few billions of ECUs. State aid. So of course, versus companies which do not benefit from the state aid, this is a very, very unsatisfactory and unfair situation. Now, unfortunately enough, the Commission has not been given the real instruments, the good instruments to fight that kind of thing, because you need unanimity on the level of Council of Ministers. That means that all the governments do have a veto right, and that's also the reason why it took us a year to try to get governments to agree to on the one hand, we accepting a certain level of state aid, and they then cutting capacity as help, as their part of the responsibility, as their part of the job to reduce capacity in the steel sector, to try to turn the sector to viability again. But as long, of course, as we cannot solve the state aid cases, other companies not aided will be extremely reluctant amongst themselves to reduce capacity. Now, we need across the sector reduction of capacity from about 30 million tons in order to have a chance to bring the sector to viability again. So you see, ladies and gentlemen, how important this kind of, well, the possibility to solve stated cases of that kind is. And as I said, when in such an area like steel, you need unanimity on the level of Council of Ministers, it becomes almost impossible. Having said this, the Commission is doing its utmost to stop this tendency to increase state aid and in, let's say, this developing of a kind of beggar my neighbor policies in the state aid field, again, because it's bad as such. Secondly, it's adding to the already very huge public deficits. And at the end of the day, it's solving nothing, because if everyone is doing it, and again, if we cannot solve these steel cases before the end of the year, what's going to happen? Because apart from what the Italian public steel company, the Spanish public steel company, Ecostal in the former Eastern Germany, other companies being now in real trouble, they have but no choice than to turn to their government and ask for money. Otherwise, they will go broke. And then, at the end of the day, you have a situation where most of the steel companies are living by virtue of state aid. And this must be avoided because it's absolutely a bad thing. And it can create the illusion that for a short while you are perhaps avoiding to shedding of some additional jobs, that's true, but only for a short while. And the situations almost certainly will be even more difficult after that. So therefore, we are facing this difficult political circumstances, but I think we absolutely, as a commission, must stick to our former policy and not give in to this tendency that just for a short while you can create the illusion that you're solving a problem, while in the real world it isn't at all. Let me turn now, briefly, ladies and gentlemen, to another chapter, and then in 10 minutes' time I hope that I can finish, and so then turn to the questions. A very important dimension of competition policy, or an increasing important dimension of competition policy, is the external side. Up to now in the community, we have concentrated, as we needed to do, on what was happening in the community. And we needed to do so because one of the instruments to bring about the single market is competition policy. So it is not just an instrument as such, it was also an instrument of trying to develop and to create a single market. And by the way, that's still what we are doing in telecom. We try to do it in energy sector, we try to do it in ground handling sectors, and so on. But having said this, increasingly we experience that we need to develop also the external dimension. Why? First of all, because more and more cases will be cases which go far beyond the community as such. Actually, we are investigating cases which are investigated also by the American authorities. And therefore, my predecessor, Sir Leon Britton, already tried to develop some ways of cooperation between the two sides of the Atlantic. It's not easy because both sides are bound by laws. For instance, crucial information and data cannot be given because protected by secrecy. So it's not very easy to develop that cooperation, but there is a need to do so. Secondly, increasingly, I would say there is a problem of level playing field. Because if markets will be more open, and just before coming to this gathering, I got a message that apparently the get round is going rather well, at least on the level of those negotiating, in particular Sir Leon Britton and Mike Cantor. So apparently they are very near to strike a deal. Let's wait and see what's happening elsewhere on the level of Council of Ministers and in some capitals. But okay, it seems to be well underway, and that's good news. Having said this, it does not solve the problem of a level playing field when we are talking about competition. That's a different matter. The gap negotiation is dealing with restraints which have been put there by public authorities. But this round of negotiations is not about what's happening by way of private restraints. Why market access is not possible in some countries or is extremely difficult, for instance in Japan, in some sectors. These negotiations are not at all giving an answer to that. That's something different. But it is part of the problem. It is part of the problem. And the need to develop a level playing field is increasingly there, and certainly for those economies which are the most open ones. And in this respect, ladies and gentlemen, I think, whether one likes it or not, gradually we have to address four different types of challenges. One is this private restraints, and for a month I have been in Japan to discuss this with the Japanese authorities, because it happens that this is one of the major cases. There are other countries as well. But as we try sincerely to bring about liberalization in most of the sectors, to try to reduce the companies and sectors sheltered by a situation of monopoly or exclusive rights, and try to enlarge all the sectors which undergo normal competition or are part of the normal commercial sector, we should be able also to tell our companies that they will be given fair chances elsewhere as well. Now, how can you put aside, or can you cope with this kind of private restraints? Private restraints being restraints not coming or not stemming from laws, or as such by way of public intervention of the public authorities, but being of industry, of sectors, or attitudes which make it extremely difficult for competitors to get in the market. And again, that's what's happening in many sectors, for instance in Japan, because of the distribution system, which is peculiar, because of the relationship between the major companies and the smaller companies doing business with them. It's extremely difficult to get in that kind of system, and so on and so on. But again, then we are not talking about a fair system of competition when we are talking about the level playing field in the world. So after this round of debt negotiations, what needs to be tackled is that kind of private restraints. And I'm not pretending that we do not have some kind of debt restraints in our community. Certainly are. So we should be prepared then to talk about it as well. But we must insist that other countries, and certainly the countries having huge trade surpluses with the community or with other countries, will be prepared and should be prepared to look into that. Now, as it happens, the actual Japanese government seems to be prepared to do so and has a program of deregulation, and some of the ministers publicly even accept that there is a big problem. I just recall a declaration made by the minister responsible for MITI some time ago, and he admitted publicly that big business, and I'm quoting the minister, big business in Japan is a hotbed of collusion. So not just any kind of European Commission inventing something. No, it has been admitted publicly by one of the major ministers. So this is a problem, and again, we need to tackle this question now, and therefore I have been suggesting on behalf of the Commission that after the successful dealing of this GATT round, that preferably in a GATT framework, we should try to reach a kind of minimum rules allowing to tackle these problems, and also procedures to do so. Because it's not good enough just to say you need to have a minimum laws in the competition fields, because from time to time there is a big difference between having laws and implementing laws, as we all know. So it needs to be a serious procedure to make not only discussions possible, but to challenge situations and decisions which are not in accordance with what is meant here. Briefly, and to conclude, ladies and gentlemen, three other observations related to this external dimension. The monetary dimension, the environmental one, and the social one. Monetary field, you certainly, as I do, from time to time witness that countries around the world which try to enhance their competitive position and their trade try to use their money for their purposes. It has nothing to do, or not much to do anymore, with the real value. But it has to do with trying to get into markets and to beat competitors in that way, on top of perhaps the other good arguments they might have. Also, for this kind of situations, we need to have minimum rules, or at least that it should be possible to deal with these questions. I'm not pretending it will be easy, but at least it should be a matter on which we can talk with each other. We do not have the system, the Bretton Woods system anymore, that's true. which put some discipline and some certainty into the monetary system. That's gone for a long time. But the problem is there now. The problem is there. And again, I'm not pleading for a system which will be too rigid. No, I'm just pleading for a situation and for rules of the game when these questions can be discussed and eventually can be tackled. The same is true for environmental standards. Now, you certainly are aware of the discussion which took place in the US related to the NAFTA agreement. And if it did take place there, it's just not by chance. It is just because it increasingly becomes a real problem. It is hard to see how we can go on, as we have been doing over the last years, to impose more and more stricter rules and standards on our companies, as we need to do for good environmental reasons, in a realistic way. And again, there is no reason to believe that we just can stop where we are today. It needs to go on. But if we go on with that policy, and others barely take notice of that, and are not prepared to go into the same direction, I'm not saying that others need to copy the same standards, because they will not be able to do so, and it will take a long time before they can do so. That's not what I'm saying, that they need to quickly reach the same levels. It would be completely unrealistic, and it would probably be not very defendable either. But on the other hand, there again, there must be at least a beginning of minimum rules and procedures whereby these questions can be tackled. And in this respect, I think what has been agreed by way of side letters as far as NAFTA is concerned is something important. Also, in my view, it is a first step what needs to be done elsewhere as well. And the same applies for social issues. Now, I know this is a very tricky question and it's not an easy one, but there again, it's hard to see where those trying to protect, or at least to have minimum rules to protect their workers for very good reasons, should be out of business because others do not have rules, and certainly in regimes which are not democratic ones, and where the normal play cannot take place. If the normal play can, okay, then it is a matter of development. Then it is a matter of development. And you have to accept that kind of logic. But where that is not the case, there cannot be a minimum of level playing field, and we have to acknowledge that. And public opinion is increasingly becoming aware of that. So therefore, this set of questions needs to be addressed in a proper way, in a realistic way, in a gradual way, step by step, but need to be addressed. So therefore, ladies and gentlemen, this gives you, I think, a rather different view as the more classical approach to competition policy, and certainly as the more traditional competition policy we have been pursuing, and again, as was understandable, as needed to be done until recently. But now the challenges are different, we need different solutions, and we need also to acknowledge that we have to make up our mind, also as far as competition policy is concerned, losing sight of what's happening in the real world, inside the community and outside the community. So, Chairman, that's what I wanted to say by way of introduction. Now I'm ready to face questions and criticism and whatever message you have got. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for your that certainly mind-enhancing talk and very stimulating ideas that will certainly play a very big role in the future and in the discussions coming up very soon. Mr. Karl-Famiert has kindly agreed to answer questions, so please, if you would like to go ahead, but may I just ask you to be very brief, not to make statements, but ask a question. So go ahead, please. Shall we start with that one?
Sorry.
Well, first of all, you have to have a clear view on what the market is and what it's all about, what's happening in the real world. And if you notice that that if just all, well, the different companies within the European Community go ahead all for themselves, probably not reach thereby the results to make them real competitors with companies which are ahead already, then I think the conclusion is, and from the point of view of competition, because what's the good of competition if the three of them will be out of business because they could not join forces? And on the other hand, that it's also, and I do not apologize for that, that if in joining forces they can be still in business within a few years, okay, that's good for employment and that's good for our economy. So this has been taken into account, but again, after having scrutinized the situation, after having come to the conclusion that the real challenge is a world challenge and not just a challenge within the European Community. And therefore we could agree to it. Now, it might be different in other sectors, but here it was a clear-cut case and it has not been, not to my knowledge, certainly not in the Commission, it has not been disputed. Right, well, although this is primarily the responsibility of Sully and Britain, I think we are in complete agreement and therefore I do not have any hesitation to tell you what our position is. And by the way, that's also with the agreement of Sully, and I told the Japanese authorities. And up to now, we do have a different approach as the Americans have. And we say to the Japanese authorities, okay, if you can prove us that it works the other way around, the better. The better. So if you are serious, and the actual government apparently is, to open up markets, or at least by way of deregulation, try to do away with some of these old-fashioned practices which do not allow some of our companies to penetrate in that market, in spite, for instance, now of the competitive edge because of the strong yen. But if it does not work, and if the Americans are more successful, and on top of that, it might backfire as far as our interests are concerned. Let me give you an example. A company complained, one of the managers of a European company complained to me that in the aeronautics sector, clearly they made the best bid. They clearly had the best file. But it was not given to the European company, it was given to an American company because apparently they did take commitments versus the Americans in that sector. So it was managed in that way. Now, okay, this is a case, there might be a few others, but we still tend to believe that probably by insisting on removing private restraints, by insisting on trying to make it multilateral as well, not only bilateral, but multilateral, perhaps we could be successful as well. Now, for the rest, we will see how things develop. And the Japanese are well aware, if, of course, they give some advantages to the Americans, and eventually even to the detriment of the European Community, then almost certainly the European Community is going to insist on using the same instruments. And this is, to some extent, a danger. Now, a last remark, perhaps, on managed trade. We try to avoid that as much as we can. Now, there might be a few sectors where, for good reasons, for a limited period of time, you have to go for it. Let me give you the example of steel, where we are engaged in this huge restructuring program, 30 million tons tons to be reduced. I'm not sure we're going to reach that objective. Shedding almost one quarter of the jobs in that sector, which is very considerable. Then you cannot not allow in such a process that at the same time your market will be completely destroyed or almost completely destroyed by cheap imports. So therefore you have to manage that. That will not say close the door. And in fact, on the basis of 91, imports of these countries will develop, but in a managed way, to make sure that they are not going to threaten the policy of trying to, well, turn the sector, if possible, to viability again. So in this respect, there can be exceptions, but it needs, let's say, we need to be convinced that that there is a real need for such a managed trade. May I turn to that question? Yes? Right. But you are talking about the steel agreement within the European community? Yeah, because there is another steel agreement under negotiation, as you know, with the Americans and the others. Okay, I guess you must have in mind the EcoStyle case. Well, I'm not sure everyone is so familiar with this case. EcoStyle used to be, one of the prestige objects or projects of the former regime near the Polish border. So they did put there a steel plant, not a complete steel plant, because the hot rolled capacity was not yet there. But the liquid phase was there and the cold phase was there. About 13,000 people were working there till 89. In the meantime, the number of workforce has been reduced to about 3,500, and the restructuring plan now points to a further reduction around 2,000 people. So that means really an extremely dramatic reduction of the workforce there. Now, other steel plants were closed down in the former GDR, and now also for political reasons, but for social reasons as well, they want to keep this plant. And it's becoming a huge political problem and a kind of symbol as well. The trouble is that in order to make it to have a chance to turn into a viable plant, you need to invest in hot rolling capacity, which is exactly one of the sectors where there is huge overcapacity and where we have to insist that other plants close down or reduce their capacity. So you see the problem. On the one hand, for good reasons, normally speaking, one should be able to say, okay, go ahead. And it's true, if you want to make it a viable plant, you have to invest in hot rolling capacity. That's the normal economic reasoning in other circumstances. But today, it was of course very difficult just to accept it like that. Because, again, elsewhere, you have to insist to close this kind of capacity. Now, given the very specific situation in the eastern part of Germany, given the situation that capacity has been reduced in the former GDR job, anyway, finally we could reach an agreement whereby this new capacity will be limited. It should be no more than 900,000 tons. Even if the capacity is such as more, but it should not produce more than 900,000 tons. And also, in order to be able to accept the state aid involved, because if it is not done, if it is done without state aid, no problem. I mean, then it's not our case, because we cannot avoid anyone putting money anywhere. I mean, so, but the problem is a lot of state aid is involved. Therefore, we had to insist, in order to be able to accept that program, at least as a commission, that capacity, additional capacity should be closed down elsewhere. Now, this could be done, or it has been agreed that it should be done in Henningsdorf, which, by the way, belongs to the private company which is going to take over EcoStyle. So it's a little bit of a complicated case, and again, we could only live with such such an agreement because of the very peculiar and specific situation of Eastern Germany. I'm sorry, having been a little bit specific, but otherwise, yes. Okay. Well, as you know, we are immensely popular everywhere in the European community. I have been elected over and over again, so... But before becoming a member of the Commission, I must admit, it is true that increasingly we are becoming a kind of scapegoat. Because, certainly in this depressed economic situation, we need to take decisions or to prepare decisions which anyway need to be taken, but where governments like us to take the initiative or to take not the credits for it, but for the blame for it. Now, that's life these days, and it's hard to see how we can get away from it. So I do have not any illusions about the Commission becoming more popular. But someone needs to play that role. I often compare our situation, and certainly when it comes to state aid or that kind of files, our situation to that one of the referee. Well, if you do not have a referee, it's hard to see how you will have a football game after 5 minutes. Or if you allow the players to implement the rules and to look after the rules, you're sure what's going to happen. A football game will be over in a few minutes and it's becoming a completely different game. I don't, perhaps no game anymore. But, well, that's the real situation. Now, a referee, in the best of cases, will not be blamed. But he hardly gets credit when the game is okay. Then the others will get the credit. If it turns out to be a difficult game, then he will be blamed. Well, that's it. But I always tend to add to that, we are well paid for that kind of role. No, but it is a real, no, it is a real problem. And ladies and gentlemen, I can tell you, when I was in charge of competition policy, and it was a mandate for 4 years, I had to do business in the 4 years' time with more than 40 ministers. Even in Great Britain, I had 4 transport ministers in 4 years' time. In France, it was the same, 3 in Germany. I'm sorry to say that I didn't count them in Greece. Not exactly. But this just gives an impression of what the trouble is. The only, let's say, player in the field who can act with coherence and over a certain period and therefore develop in a coherent way a policy is the Commission in many fields these days. I know it's not very popular to say that, but that's the truth. That's the truth. Now, why do you think that in spite of our immense popularity, we have not been abolished yet? Well, that's because in the real world, even those criticizing very heavily the Commission, in fact know that if you abolish the Commission, you do not have a game anymore. You do not have a community anymore. And if you abolish it tomorrow, one way or another, you have to create another commission. You can call it differently, but the functions need to be pursued anyway. Otherwise, that's the end of the European community. And by the way, and let me tell you that here in London, one of our main problems these days is not that there is too much community. One of our main problems is, and of our society, is that there is not enough community. And now, time is running out. Thank you very much for listening.